Why do we need to keep mind, body, and brain in mind when it comes to trauma? How has brain science changed the way we view trauma? And does memory play a role in PTSD? We'll get into all that and more in this bonus session with Dr. Pat Ogden and Dr. Ruth Buzinski.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this bonus session. I'm Dr. Ruth Buzinski, a licensed psychologist in the state of Connecticut and the president of the National Institute for the Clinical Application of Behavioral Medicine. But you know that already because you've been joining us for several of our webinars in this series. Today, we are going to look at the brain from a very different perspective. We're going to talk about what goes on in the brain when someone has experienced trauma. And to do that, we brought in a worldwide expert on the treatment of trauma, Dr. Pat Ogden. She is the author of Sensory Motor Psychotherapy, Interventions for Trauma and Attachment, and also Trauma and the Body, a Sensory Motor Approach to Psychotherapy. And Pat, there are a lot of people on this webinar, some of whom may not know what somatic means or sensory motor psychotherapy. So I guess, why do we use the term somatic, and what do we mean by it?
Okay, well, somatic is just a term that means pertaining to the body. So somatic psychotherapy has to do really with how the body holds PTSD and attachment issues, and how we, you know, how we can work through the body to help those issues heal.
So brain science is really hot right now. But why should we not forget about the body? I think you would make the argument that you can't just go off and explain everything from a brain point of view, but that you need to think about the body and the integration of the two. But can you defend that or articulate that?
There's so many ways to look at it. Some of the new research that I'm excited about is something that we've known forever in body psychotherapy, and that's that posture and movement actually does affect the brain. There's some very exciting new research coming out of Harvard. I believe Amy Cuddy is the primary researcher, and she is showing how what she calls power poses affect cortisol and testosterone, and she's done studies on if people take on for 2 minutes a power pose with an erect spine. She calls it, I think, the Wonder Woman pose, you know, confident, upright, that actually the cortisol lowers and the testosterone raises. That's with 2 minutes of changing your body. And I think that really speaks to how effective working with movement and posture can be in terms of shifting even hormone levels, let alone mood, stress, anxiety.
I don't know what level of detail you got into in reviewing that study, but do you know, did she pull in subjects and you know, measure stuff and then have them sit different ways, or how did she do it?
She did. She measured testosterone and she measured cortisol, and she had a control group and then people who took on these postures, and she's, you know, discovered that cortisol was lower, testosterone was raised. She also did a study where people saw videos of these people in different postures and were asked which ones they would see as more confident or higher for a job. And of course, they picked the people who looked confident. So I think this is something we've always known as body therapists. In fact, I can tell you a personal story. I think it was the late 70s when I first started teaching. I was very shy, and I was terrified, actually, to speak in front of people. Now I can speak in front of hundreds, and I'm fine. But then I was so nervous and so shy. And Ron Kurtz, who is my most important mentor, he said, just go into class and puff up your chest. He said, you'll be fine. He said, it'll change your whole mood. And he was right. So we've known that and used it, you know, for years, but now they're finding the research to actually confirm our way of working with the body. It's very exciting to me.
Cuddy, you said it was Amy Cuddy, C-U-T-T-Y?
C-U-D-D-Y. She's a social psychologist out of Harvard.
Okay. That is so interesting. And we know that testosterone generally is thought of as, in addition to being a male hormone and related to sexual arousal, it's also thought to be a well-being, a measure of well-being.
Exactly. And confidence and self-esteem. And I think one of the important elements of this study is that how we hold ourselves in our bodies, you know, and the body language that we exhibit not only communicates to others how we're feeling and how assertive we feel or how self-confident, it also implicitly communicates to ourselves. So if we take PTSD, you know, there and look at the different ways that lives in each individual's body, then we can start, you know, working directly with the body to help, I think, resolve some of those symptoms.
Let's follow that idea up a little more. But before we do, let me ask you just a few more things. How does the body influence the mind and the brain?
It's a very constant influence. You know, I mean, if we even just tighten our bodies right now, or lift our shoulders or widen our eyes, which is a position of fear. If you take on this posture for a few minutes, you will actually start feeling afraid. And, you know, some of our clients have that posture chronic, and they go through life like this with in a constant state of anticipation of danger. But if we have an aligned but relaxed body, you know, then we feel better about ourselves, and we communicate very differently with others.
Now you and go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, what I was going to say is that trauma profoundly affects, I think, how we live in our body, and it dysregulates our nervous system as well, and our attachment history over time also shapes how we live in our body. So we've always got these two influences that overlap: our relational history, and then whatever traumas we've experienced.
So let's talk about, you said that trauma influences how we live in our body. What do you mean by that?
Trauma stimulates instinctive responses. We usually think of them as fight or flight, or a freeze response, or, you know, a collapse response, a feigned death. And often those responses endure, you know, long after the trauma is over.
So the trauma could be a couple years ago.
Oh, it could be a childhood. And if we live in that state of stress where we're on edge with the fight or flight system is stimulated, you know, it raises cortisol and it changes our bodies. Like that position is much more tension, you know, like a hypervigilance often, a wariness, a quick trigger response, which is very different from a balanced nervous system that is not affected in that way by trauma.
So when we're holding ourselves in a hypervigilant way, we're not only wearing out our bodies, but we're also affecting our nervous system, and which is, of course, connected to the brain.
Absolutely, and our, you know, our immune system and our adrenals, and we're
overtaxed. Tell me more now. Oh, you said immune system. How do we affect the immune system?
Well, it's known that sustained levels of high cortisol can suppress a healthy immune system, for example. And there's a lot of research that really talks about people with chronic post-traumatic stress tend to have compromised immune systems and more susceptible to immune difficulties. And, you know, I mean, there's so much research on this topic with the brain. Many people with PTSD, research shows, do have elevated levels of cortisol. But Rachel Yehuda did a study, I believe, with Holocaust survivors and prolonged trauma that showed there's chronic low cortisol. But either way,
it showed what, please?
Chronic low cortisol. So when that whole system is out of balance, you know, we can't go through life as confidently and as joyfully as when it's in balance.
I wonder if the low cortisol would be associated with the what you refer to as feigned death.
It might. I'm not positive of the research with that.
I think I'd like to back up for just a minute, and because we have a lot of people on the webinar who aren't necessarily therapists. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that everyone has heard of fight or flight. That's the whole idea, that when we're surprised or in a stressful situation, we either go forward and fight it out or we flee.
Right.
But a lot of people are seeing there's really a third response, and they've named that feigned death. Can you sort of flesh out what feigned death means?
Sure. And this is knowledge from mythology. You know, when we speak of playing dead or an opossum that plays dead, that's a feigned death response. It's when fight or flight are unsuccessful, and the last resort is to play dead. And in the wild, you know, animals tend not to eat an animal that looks dead. That's another survival instinct, that, you know, the dead animal could be diseased. So this feigning death can actually protect your life in the wild. So it's very much of an instinct. But it can show up in post-traumatic stress, in feelings of immobility, not enough energy, not being able to get going, you know, on your day, a loss of interest in your life.
Has neuroscience changed the way we see trauma?
I think as a body psychotherapist, it's certainly validated how I see trauma. We now have research that really proves it's important to work with posture, it's important to work with the body. I think it's changed the public view in the sense that it's not a psychological issue as much as it is a subcortical issue that doesn't have to do with how we think. Like in the old days in World War I, for example, when soldiers had what we now call PTSD, and the flight response would take over and they would run, they were often called cowards and even shot.
It was sometimes referred to as shell shock.
Yes, that came a little later. Carter called it shell shock around World War II. But there was still such a stigma attached to it. Like there was something innately wrong with you if you had shell shock. And now I think that we're understanding that it's an illness, that every person given enough exposure to trauma would have. A psychiatrist named Ross in World War II, he said, well, every man has his breaking point. Like none of us are immune to post-traumatic stress disorder. It just depends on how much and how intense and how long, how prolonged the trauma is. And it also depends on our childhood relational history. If we had healthy, you know, relationships with our parents and our families, it sets up the brain in a certain way that gives us a better immunity to trauma.
And so you're talking about what psychotherapists refer to as attachment.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that if you had a connection, a strong enough, a good enough connection with your parent, no one has a perfect one.
Right, exactly.
It would build resilience, and that would be a buffer
yes.
to stress.
Yes.
Any thoughts on why? What is it about that early childhood experience that affects your later propensity for being resilient with stress?
Well, when we're born, you know, there's very little connectivity in the brain between the upper levels, the cortical levels of the brain, and the lower subcortical levels of the brain. That's why babies, they don't care where they are. If they're upset, they'll scream and cry. You know, there's no inhibition. There's very little connectivity. With really good parenting, that connectivity can really take place in a very optimal way for brain development. There's the idea that when a parent comforts a child and soothes the child, when the child gets aroused, that starts to develop their own ability to regulate those lower brain structures and phenomena. It builds that connectivity. So without that, you know, we don't learn on a neurological level how to regulate our anxiety or our fight or flight responses, etc.
And so then when we are exposed to trauma, we're more likely to be impacted by it.
Mm-hmm. And develop PTSD. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're less likely to have a really healthy adaptive self-regulation, you know, through life. Mm-hmm. Although, with all the research now on neuroplasticity, it's very exciting that some of what we thought was kind of hardwired in the brain, we now know can continue to change even into old age, which is very, I think, encouraging for all of us.
Can you tell me more about that?
Researchers are discovering is that when we create new experiences and have new experiences, then we can start to develop new pathways in the brain and actually start to inhibit old ones and develop new ones. And, you know, in PTSD, in working with the body, we're creating new experiences. Like if somebody with PTSD comes into your office, you know, really frightened like that, and we help them feel safe and change how they're living in their body, that's creating a new experience. So we're hoping that we're capitalizing on neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm. Now, a while back, you said that trauma in the brain is subcortical.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to go back and define subcortical and explain what you meant and why that matters.
Okay, well, it matters because it's
first,
not...
what is subcortical?
Well, subcortical just means below the cortex. The cortex is the front part of our brain, the latest part of our brain to develop. It's the thinking brain. And subcortical is under that. And, you know, the subcortical brain involves the limbic system, which is the emotional brain, and the reptilian brain. And that's the seat of our instincts. So when we have trauma, we're threatened. We feel endangered, and with every animal, including us, we are animals after all, it stimulates those subcortical survival responses, and we can't think our way out of them. That's why with PTSD, you know, people who are suffering from trauma, they often feel so unsafe, and they try to think their way out of it and say, but I'm really safe now. I'm not in the war anymore. I'm not being abused anymore. But the subcortical brain isn't so directly affected by the thoughts. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, it does. And it leads me to the next question, which is that often we would like to talk our way out of trauma. You know, or out of PTSD. I mean, you obviously wouldn't talk your way out of trauma most of the time. Sometimes that might be successful, but not often. But in a PTSD situation, people tend to either withdraw and never talk about it or talk about it and hope that talking about it will matter. Sometimes that helps, but often it doesn't. Why is that?
I think it's because of what we were talking about, that PTSD is really a dysregulation of our survival instincts. The fight or flight that is stimulated in trauma is supposed to protect us, right, from getting hurt. But when those responses continue and continue, that can turn into PTSD, and it's hard to think our way out of that. It's like people say things like, well, I know I'm safe, but my body is run amok. My heart's beating fast and my body's shaking, but I know that I'm safe. So on one level, the thinking brain knows it, but the rest of their brain doesn't.
And then when we're talking, it's like talk and logic isn't the best way to get through to that rest of the brain.
Well, that's in sensory motor psychotherapy, of course, we're wanting to work directly with the body and with the nervous system, as well as with our thoughts, of course, to try to help those levels of the brain integrate so that the lower parts of the brain can also quiet those survival responses.
What role does memory play in PTSD?
Well, it depends if you're talking about explicit memory or implicit memory.
Okay, let's define both of those in case some people don't know.
Explicit memory is something that we actually recall, like we can remember it happening, right? Implicit memory, we don't remember with words, but it still deeply affects us. Like I was working with a veteran not long ago, and he said after the first combat experience, he doesn't remember the rest of his tour, but it still affected him. It still affected him implicitly. And, you know, our early memories are all implicit. We don't remember being a baby. Our hippocampus that, you know, helps us remember is not even fully formed yet. But yet, those very early experiences deeply affect us implicitly. Mm-hmm. So memory has a huge role. And if I can say one more thing about that, the body, you often see the effects of the past in the body, even when a person doesn't remember.
Tell us more. What can you think of a time or a person to use a pseudonym and tell us about a...
Well, I'm thinking of somebody who had so much trouble in relationships and felt that people didn't want to be close to her emotionally. And her posture was kind of like this, with her chin up and her shoulders stiff. And this was how she related. And she talked in kind of an aggressive way like this. I mean, you take on this posture and you start talking that way because it changes how you feel. It changes how you feel towards others. And she was completely unaware of that and never did have concrete memories of that posture, you know, taking hold. But so somehow she must have had the experience that she needed to be tough and strong and not be vulnerable, though she didn't remember concrete examples of that. I think of somebody else. You know that Charlie Brown cartoon of that depression where he's Charlie Brown's in this very depressed posture, and he said, well, if you're going to get any joy out of your depression, you've got to be like this, he said, because if you lift yourself up, you'll start feeling better. And I know, it's true. And I had a person I was working with once, and she said, I always walk like this. She said, and it was this posture. And she said, I don't know why, but that's the way I'm supposed to walk. And that's implicit memory. She couldn't remember learning to walk that way, but yet that's how she walked.
Interesting. Now, I want to talk about mindfulness a bit. You have included mindfulness in the work that you do with people who are suffering from trauma. Why is mindfulness relevant?
Oh, gee, there's so much research that shows how mindfulness positively affects the brain. You know, it can quiet anxiety, it can increase empathy, the centers in the brain that are responsible for empathy, et cetera, et cetera. But I was using mindfulness long before I knew all that because I wanted to get beneath the content into what was driving the content. You know that saying, you can't take the engine apart when it's running? Well, mindfulness quiets our automatic responses so we can become aware of them. Okay, so if somebody's talking about a trauma, say about a rape, and they're talking about it, and you start to see them tightening up, etc., a mindfulness question would be, let's pause and can you notice what's going on inside right now? And then they start to notice that their shoulders are tensing and their eyes are widening, and that's a part of the fear response. So we start, with mindfulness, we start being able to take apart the components of the individual's disturbing response.
You've said that trauma is a failure of integration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what people, that everyone will understand what you mean by integration, but so can you tell us what you mean by integration and then tell us why you see trauma as a failure of integration?
Okay, that's actually a statement from Pierre Janet, who was a contemporary of Freud's.
Okay.
And he said trauma is a failure of integrative capacity. Like with a normal experience, we can absorb it. We can process it. With trauma, the stimulation is so intense and it causes such an intense response inside that we fail to really process it fully. And often elements of the trauma become dissociated in one way or another. We might not even remember specific pieces of the trauma, like the young man who went to war. You know, he didn't remember it. The feelings might be so overwhelming that we don't integrate them, we push them away. You know, our bodies have such strong responses that we might try to suppress or withdraw or even kind of disconnect from our bodies. So that's what a failure to integrate all the elements of the trauma.
So what would an integrated, a person who's had a traumatic experience that they have integrated, what would that look like?
Basically, it would look like the traumas in the past. It's not affecting me in the present. And they would be able to say, yeah, this is what happened. It happens in the past. It's not happening anymore. When it's not integrated, people are very easily triggered into a feeling that it's happening now. It's kind of what PTSD is. You know, a veteran of a war will hear a loud sound and they'll again be traumatized. They'll start to experience that fight or flight response. So when it's integrated, it's over. It's over.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop that. I was so happy to have the opportunity to include a piece on trauma in the Brain series. You know, you would think in a way, well, why would you do that? But I think that a lot, first of all, we're seeing so much trauma these days, and also because the brain and the body really have such an impact on trauma, and we need to understand so much more about this. So, Pat, thank you for giving us your time to talk about this. I can't think of anyone who could do it better, more justice than yeah. you.
And well, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time to do this today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.